This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday marked the fifth anniversary of the largest massacre in Europe since World War II, the massacre in Srebrenica. My guest, Alexander Heyman, is a Bosnian writer who narrowly averted the Bosnian War. He was in the U.S. on a journalist exchange program 8 years ago. The day he was scheduled to return home, his city, Sarajevo, came under siege. Heyman stayed in the U.S. and became obsessed with learning English. He gave himself 5 years to write a story in English and have it published. Now, 8 years later, he has a book of stories written in English, published by Doubleday, that is receiving rave reviews. It's called The Question of Bruno. Critic Sven Burkerts wrote in Esquire, "As vivid prose as you will find anywhere this year, and as heartbreaking." In Entertainment Weekly, the book was praised for its piercing cultural observations. Alexander Heyman says he made up his mind to stay in the U.S. even before the siege of Sarajevo. I asked him why.
Why did I want to stay? Because I wanted to live. And I guess I was not brave enough to go back.
So even before the siege, you knew that there'd be trouble?
Yeah. I was a journalist. This is the strange thing. I knew everything I needed to know. To know that there would be a war and it would be the way it was. But on the other hand, emotionally, I could not face up to that fact, and none of us could. We simply stared the facts into the face and would not see them. And that's one of the things that I thought about a lot too. And I realized that it is kind of the same mechanism that I believe human beings have, which prevents them from being able to imagine their own death. Because if we were able to imagine our own death, we would be paralyzed with fear of that. And most of the people outside of the small group of people who were actually organizing the crime could not see what was going on because it was too big. It was so much bigger than our lives that we could not see what was going on.
Before you were able to write in English, you took a lot of odd jobs. In the United States. Why don't you run through a list of some of the jobs you had in your first few years here?
Well, first, there were a few illegal jobs. I hope no one from the INS is listening to this. I served food in some place. I worked for a real estate agent who paid me less than a minimum wage, putting in real estate data into the computer. Then my first legal job was working for Greenpeace as a canvasser, which I did for 2.5 years, which was a crash course in American middle class. I worked in a bookstore. I worked as a bike messenger. I worked in a kitchen of a fast food restaurant. I worked as an ESL teacher. I worked in several bookstores. And then I was a graduate student. And now I'm a professional writer.
In one of your stories, the character talks about, this is a character in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, and he talks about how, you know, when you walk from point A to point B in Sarajevo, you risk getting killed by a sniper. But if you make it to point B, then you're momentarily thrilled to be alive, even though you're living under siege. So one of the things, you weren't living in that world of danger, but you weren't also getting that kind of surge of joy to be alive.
Right. A lot of friends of mine talked about this kind of adrenaline rush that they would have in Sarajevo because for the very fact of being able to survive, which was also, you know, would be followed by this horrible, horrible depression. It's not even the word. It sounds too mild. The horrible fear and, you know, the endless darkness that they were facing, it seemed to them, and not to mention the physical obstacles like the lack of food and lack of movement and lack of healthcare and all kinds of lacks. But this adrenaline rush made a lot of people in Sarajevo, particularly artists, do incredible things. And they were really excited to be alive in that city at that time, as strange as it sounds. Whereas I was not particularly excited to be alive in the United States at that time, although I was in a much better position, obviously.
There's a passage in your new collection, The Question of Bruno, that I'd like you to read. And this is about a character who, like you, has come to the United States from Bosnia, and he's working at a restaurant. Would you introduce this passage for us, set the context for us?
Well, my character, Josef Pronek, who had decided to stay in the United States because of the war in Bosnia, has to find a job. And so he goes out and finds a job in a bakery that serves sandwiches of all kinds. His duty is described as the kitchen help. So he's at work at this moment. He was listlessly piling up trays on the top of the bin when a man in a grass-green shirt with a golfer shade swinging a golf club in its coronary area said, "Young man, would you please come here?" Pranik obediently walked to the man's table and stood there as vague hatred brewed in his muscles. The man had nicely combed blonde hair, and Pranik could see the immaculate line disappearing into the pate. The man pointed at the croissant on his plate. There was a monstrous golden seal ring on his pinky, and he said, "I wanted romaine lettuce on my turkey Dijon. Excuse me, but this is not romaine lettuce. This is iceberg lettuce. What do you have to say about that?" Pranik was about to go and tell the sandwich person about the problem, but then, abruptly overwhelmed with the desire not to be there at the moment, said, "Nothing." "I'd like my turkey Dijon with romaine lettuce, please," the man said. "What's difference?" Pranik said. "Excuse me?" The man raised his voice, his double chin doubly corrugated in disbelief. "Romaine lettuce, iceberg lettuce, what's difference?" Pranik said, with a sudden vision of stuffing the lettuce leaf into the man's mouth. "May I talk to someone who can speak English, please?" the man said, and pushed his tray away with resolve as the croissant shuddered and slid to the edge of the plate. Pranik felt pain climbing up his calves, passing his pelvis to settle in his stomach as a cramp. He wanted to say something clever that would smash the man, but could not think of any English words that could convey the magnitude of the absurdity other than romaine lettuce, iceberg lettuce, what's the difference? He kept mumbling it to himself, like a magic word that would make him fly, and wobbled away in a vain hope that the man might just give it up. But the man naturally did not give it up, for he demanded, and rightly so, full and responsible service for his hard-earned money.
I'm wondering if when you were working, before you had really brushed up on your English, people often assumed that you were stupid because you didn't speak the language well.
That is true. And in fact, when I taught English as a second language, I would have students, most of my students for one reason or another were Russian Jews or Jews from the former Soviet Union. And some of them were literally rocket scientists. Some of them were inventors, and they would design things and gadgets for cars that would be pursued by General Motors. But they would be on level 2 and could not figure out the plural of ox. They would say oxes rather than oxen, as if they would, you know, encounter a herd of oxen on the streets of Chicago any time. So they needed to know the plural. And this kind of condescension, it is so frequent and so insulting to people who have had full lives and very complicated lives. And I would tell my students that some of them would be so ashamed of their accent that they would decide, which is impossible, to learn the English and then start speaking it. They wanted to be assimilated. They wanted to work on their accents. Until very recently, I was working at the Literacy Center in Chicago, where most of the learners were, you know, non-native speakers. And more than a half of them would come in, and when we would ask them what is it that they wanted to work on first, they would say speaking, that is the accent. They wanted to have the accent gone.
How did you go about learning the language? You already knew some of it when you decided to stay, but not enough to really write. How did you go about learning pronunciations and the words themselves?
Well, I never really worked on my accent. I worked as a canvasser for Greenpeace, so I had to talk a lot and without having any time to be self-conscious. And I didn't.
So you're going door to door canvassing people for Greenpeace?
Yes. So you know, I never worried about my accent. But the other good thing about canvassing was that you pick up on, you know, the colloquial idiomatic things, which are not hard to pick up on. So there was one way of learning, just talking a lot and being involved in exchanges with people. But also I read obsessively at the beginning. I still do read a lot, obviously, but I read when I wasn't working. I read. That's what I did. I read and worked and ate and slept. And I would make lists of words that I did not understand and then look them up in the dictionary. I had the Advanced Learner Oxford Dictionary, or the Oxford Dictionary for an Advanced Learner, it was called. And so I would look up these words. Some of them I have to look up 10, 12 times because I understood them. Understood them in a sense that I could use them as I write, that is, with all the little implications and the aura around the world, the word, and so on. And I guess it sounds, you know, complicated now, but whatever language you write in, you learn to write in that language, and you learn the language that you use to write by reading. This happens to any writer in any language at any time, except I had to do it, you know, quickly.
There's a character in one of your stories who's walking down what's called the Magnificent Mile in Chicago, and he finds himself thinking of the film The Magnificent Seven. I'm wondering if you made any bizarre word associations, because there were words that you had known for a long time in English back from your days in Sarajevo, and now you are encountering them while actually trying to learn the English language.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way. I wasn't aware of that at the time, but it seems to me that what you're saying is true. The Magnificent Seven, I mean, the word magnificent was always, and it still is, as you were talking, I understood that, was always related to this film, The Magnificent Seven. It's Yul Brynner and other guys.
Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen, yes. But yeah, it is. I picked up some words. The way, I guess, you get words, if you're not in an English-speaking country, is you get them in strange streams, you know, from odd places, because you're not aware of the context that they're attached to. They just come to you, in a sense. And, you know, I watched American movies, which were not dubbed, but subtitled. And also I listened to, you know, pop music that had English lyrics. And I knew all these words, but I was not always aware how exactly they function.
Did you find that when you started writing in English, that you started writing about different subjects or writing in a stylistically different way than you did when you were in Bosnia?
I did, indeed. When I was in Bosnia, I wrote these kind of minimalistic stories, which were really a symptom of helplessness and the lack of imagination that will allow me to imagine the magnitude of evil that was to come. So, but I am a different writer in English, absolutely. But it's also, I'm a different person, and this change, the switch from the language, my previous language to this language, was related to my, you know, transformation as a person. I still do write in Bosnian, however. I write for a magazine in Sarajevo called Dani. I write a biweekly column in Bosnian.
My guest is Alexander Heyman. His new collection of short stories is called The Question of Bruno. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alexander Heyman. He's a Bosnian writer who has lived in the U.S. since shortly before the siege of Sarajevo. Do you have friends or family who stayed in Sarajevo and lived in Bosnia throughout the siege and were really transformed by it and are really, as far as you can tell, like different people now?
I do have friends. One of my best friend he spent 3.5 years in the Bosnian army, and it was not easy for him because his ethnicity was not exactly good for being in the Bosnian army, let's say. But he's not a transformed person. He has changed, but changed in ways that I could anticipate knowing him so well. And so we had to do some catching up. But other than that, it wasn't a spectacular transformation. There were people who were my friends before the war, and then they chose their nation over their neighbors, which kind of ended our friendship. And so I don't know to the exact ways in which they changed, but they became nationalistic and, you know, bloodthirsty in some ways.
Now, I read that one of your Shakespeare teachers ended up in the Milosevic government, and you saw him on TV.
Well, I saw him everywhere because he wasn't in the Milosevic government. He was in the Bosnian Serb government, which was controlled by Milosevic, strictly speaking. He was my professor in college. He didn't. He taught poetry and criticism and all kinds of things. He was well versed in Shakespeare, and he spoke English fluently. He taught in Champaign at the University of Illinois at some point, because the Champagne, I mean, University of Illinois Champagne has a huge slag department. And he was a rather brilliant man. I liked him as a teacher very much. I graduated in 1990, and in 1991, he joined the Serbian Nationalist Party. And I worked at the magazine at the time. I would go to news conference where he would be along, and the conference would be held by Radovan Karadzic, who was way on the top of the list of war criminals in former Yugoslavia. And so after the conference, I would go in, the press conference, I would go and greet him. And he would tell me things like, you should stay out of this, you should stick to literature. And then in 92 and 93, he became obviously heavily involved in the crimes committed in Bosnia. And the word has it, and I'm not sure this is exactly true, that he was kind of the instigator of the burning of the library in Sarajevo, the infamous burning of the library with a lot of books, which is ironic since he was a literature professor. And he, you know, publicly denied the existence of camps and rapes and such. He was kind of a Rosenberg-like war criminal. He would have been had he not shunned himself. He wasn't directly involved in military operations, I don't think. But he was, you know, being a soft-spoken, English-speaking intellectual. He was involved with foreign journalists and was a kind of a propaganda man. In a sense, he shot himself in 1995, I believe. Took two shots.
When you were studying with him, did you know much about his politics, and did your knowledge of his politics interfere with your taking him seriously as a professor of Shakespeare?
I did not know his politics, and the politics were invisible. And the way he taught literature is in a kind of a new critical tradition, the way it was taught in this country for a long time until, you know, at least until the feminist revolution, let's say, which, you know, assumes that the work of art is a thing unto itself, that the only thing that you need to understand is how the internal structure of a poem or a novel, that things outside of it do not matter. So, and his politics, it was not visible at the time. I mean, he would not say anything in the class. And then we busied ourselves with, you know, analyzing poems and, you know, finding rhymes and decoding images and all this. So his politics, it was completely invisible. But then I realized later on that it was still political, this kind of attitude towards literature, in which it is just this thing that exists outside of the realm of general human experience, outside of politics or, you know, everyday practices, this realm where we go when we want to be excited and, you know, reach the divine realms and all this neo-romantic stuff. And I realized that while I was busying myself analyzing poems, he was plotting a crime. And I've, you know, felt terribly guilty for not being conscious enough, although I was very young at the time, so I guess I kind of eventually forgave myself. But I then busily tried to detect the moment or the moments when his politics were his genocidal proclivities, let's say, were detectable. And so I reread a lot of books that he taught, and a lot of poems, and then some news, and completely changed the way I thought about literature.
It changed the way you thought about literature?
Yes. I mean, thinking about it. Thinking about what his role was in all that. I suddenly realized that literature at one level or another is always political, and it always implies a political attitude. And it's not this thing outside of all that, but in a sense, in the center. The center of all that.
You said that a new language developed in Bosnia during the war. And this was a period when you weren't there to hear any new expressions. What were you able to glean about new expressions?
Well, if, you know, a language is always related to the experience of the people who speak it, then the war was a different experience, and it transformed the language in many ways. You know, the words, the military words. I translated the works, some of the writing of my friend and arguably the greatest living Bosnian writer, Semezen Mehmedinović. His book is Sarajevo Blues. I translated it into English because largely I wanted to show it to some people. It's the best book written about the war and stuff. And I had some of the words, I had to call up my friends who were, you know, under siege, who were in the war, and ask them, what is this? The words may be for, you know, some kind of piece of military equipment, or where there was a word for a martyr fighter in the Bosnian army. and, you know, a large number of other words. The word for, which is incredibly beautiful to me in a strange way, the word for the point of impact of a shell on the street, which is a little crater with rays around it, the word for that became the word that is, I mean, the word for rose, a flower. And, you know, I came upon that word, and suddenly it was confusing to me. I did not know what it was until I saw it when I went back to Sarajevo. And so my experience was entirely different here from the experience of people in Sarajevo. And I had no words in Bosnian to describe this experience here. And words in Bosnian that I knew were kind of inadequate to describe the experience that was, or to understand the experience of the people in Sarajevo and Bosnia.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Alexander Heyman's new collection of short stories is called The Question of Bruno. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.